Okay, so we're continuing to talk to kids, and does anybody remember what we talked about last week? As an incentive to make you answer quickly, I'll be slurping coffee into the microphone until you answer.
I remember it was an interesting question.
Yeah.
Was it about sin?
Sin and temptation. Sin and temptation was where we were last week. So we've kind of pivoted away from what would technically be called theology, just the doctrine of God and how to talk to kids about God, into what we're going to call really the doctrine of the gospel. So we're going to talk about sin last week and temptation and topics related to that. Today we're going to talk about the gospel story itself. And then next week we're going to start talking about a person's response to the gospel. And in particular, because I know this is the question a lot of you have asked, we'll talk about baptism and how to start talking about that. We're going to be probably more sensitive, well, I'm not sensitive to anything, but we're going to attempt to be more sensitive to the topic of age concerns now, more than before, because that's going to very much differ from kid to kid, age to age, even gender to gender, right? Girls and boys don't mature at the same level, or so I've been told. I have boys, so I'm just listening to other people tell me this. What are our basic guidelines? We're going to get a basic idea for ourselves of the topic, which would be step one. This one's especially important today. I mean, if your kid wants to know the gospel, and for you it's just kind of a word the preacher uses sometimes, we're not going to get very far. So you need to have a thought about what is the gospel story that I want to convey to my children. You're going to translate it into childese, make some kind of sense out of it. We're going to get a metaphor or simile if possible. There's not a lot for that when it comes to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. It's a story on its own, in its own right. And so there's not a lot of metaphor where we're going to compare it to another story. C.S. Lewis will help us a little bit, but that's as close as we can get. Yeah, deal with it. Hey, I had two Narnia clips, and I just cut it down to one, so I feel like, you know. Use biblical metaphor whenever possible. Yeah, again. Tolerate misunderstandings. Of all the areas where we've said tolerate misunderstandings, I'm going to suggest with the gospel would be the narrowest margin for error. Does that make sense? I mean, that we're actually trying to convey events that happened. And it's fairly significant that they get the main ideas right. And so if they don't understand the Holy Spirit, they're going to be in really good company. But if the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus is not on their radar in a pretty clear way, then we have some more work to do. So I don't want to be legalist about it and say, you don't get your kids to say it this way. But do you understand that this one requires more specificity than does some of the other topics we talk about? And then we are going to still encourage questions and imagination. And they'll have some. I mean, Zach Caldwell was 12, maybe, when he wandered into my office and said, why did Jesus have to die? Like, why did it have to? Why couldn't it have been some other way? Why couldn't there have been, like, a second plan? And you know, it's a really thoughtful question from a 12-year-old boy who's thinking about the gospel. And that's what you want to have happen, right? Is that they're having these questions. And I said, well, you only died for our sins. No, that's not what I'm asking. Why did it have to be that? Was there other options and God picked that? It's like, no, I think that's the way it had to be. Why did it have to be that? That's a complicated question. Okay, so that's the kind of, we want that, but it means you're going to have to be willing to engage that yourself, right? Because it's a tough question. Why does it have to be that? Okay, so what's the gospel briefly? The shortest, most succinct statement of the gospel comes from 1 Corinthians 15, 3-4. So let me just, first of all, give you some terminology to help you out. You can't tell when I say it, but when I write it, capital G gospel, I mean like Matthew is a gospel, Mark is a gospel, Luke is a gospel. So a gospel, we have four gospel accounts. Okay, they are texts within themselves, the gospel of Matthew. Okay. Lower G gospel is used throughout the New Testament to describe the basic story that comes out of those gospels with a big G. Does that make sense? So the life of Christ is more than just the end of those stories or any one of those stories, but the most succinct you can say it is what Paul says here. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures. Okay, that is as succinct as possible, to the point that even there, you feel like you've left some things out. Because we haven't said anything here about the life of Jesus. What Paul's saying here is just absolute, what does he call it? First importance. Which means there are other things that are of secondary importance. Secondary important does not mean unimportant. I want to say that clearly, because when I say this, people mishear me. You're saying the other stuff isn't important? The other stuff is important. But there is a first place, and that means there is a second place. Probably a third and a fourth, too. But there is a first place of chief importance, and Paul says, this is it. Same thing Jesus does when they say, what's the most important commandment in the law? He could have said, well, they're all important. But instead he said, well, here's number one and number two. Love your God and love your neighbor. He's not saying that none of the others matter. He's just saying, this is most important. And Paul's doing something similar here for us. This is most important. This is what I received. Paul said this, when God wanted to give it to me in a nutshell, this is what he said. Christ died for our sins. So first of all, Christ, notice he says Christ and not Jesus, which is a mild side point, but Christ means Messiah. So he's saying the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, died, and he did so because of sin. Okay, so those three statements have a lot packed into them, don't they? The Jewish Messiah died because of sin, according with the Scriptures. He's going to say that twice in this one long sentence. This wasn't an accident. This is what was supposed to happen. He was buried, and I think that's interesting. Of all the details in this sentence, which would you think is the least important detail? He was buried. Okay, yeah, he's buried. But he mentions it, right, that he's not a little dead. He's completely dead. He's buried in the tomb, completely dead, and he stayed there. Okay? He is buried, and then he is raised on the third day, again, in accordance with the Scriptures. Both the tragedy and the victory are scriptural. They were anticipated. This is what's supposed to happen. The death, burial, and resurrection. So that, in a nutshell, is the basic idea of what we mean when we say gospel. The word gospel means good news. This is the good news announcement. Okay, that the Messiah did come. We killed him. He lives. Okay, that basic idea is what's going on there. Any questions about that passage and what we mean by gospel? A confusion that we sometimes get to, and Churches of Christ do it, and a lot of other kind of evangelical type churches do it. Sometimes when we say gospel, we mean like the invitation to obey, or the altar call. That sometimes the gospel is confused with the response to the gospel. And so if you're not telling people to do a certain thing at the end of your sermon, well, you didn't preach the gospel. In my mind, there's a distinction. There's the response to the gospel, which in theory would follow next, right? That's going to be next week's lesson. But the gospel itself is the story. That's the good news. That's what it means. Here's what I'm telling you happened. And then we hope, if we tell it right, people say, that's amazing, what do I do now? And that's something new. So, in translation, what details do we want to talk about, and which ones are we going to struggle with kids? We want to probably talk about the trials of Jesus. Now, I don't think you have to do like full courtroom reenactments of the trials of Jesus. That's not my point. But at some point, your kid might ask, why did Jesus die? And not just for sins. Yes, we want to talk about that. But somebody decided to kill him. The Pharisees didn't say, we should kill him for the sins of mankind. They killed him for some other reason. Okay. So you might want to say something about that. We're going to talk about the crucifixion itself. Okay, that's dicey territory. That's rated R territory. Okay, so we'll have to talk about that. The burial, ancient burial customs are not the same as modern burial customs. So we might want to say something about that. The little pictures in the storybook aren't going to look like the cemetery. Okay, I hope. The resurrection, don't leave that off. This, if I have to slap the hands of evangelicals generally, there's a tendency to say, Jesus died at the end, right? And the gospel is always, Jesus died and he's alive, right? That he is not a failed Messiah, he is a resurrected Messiah. And so the resurrection is infinitely important. And then finally, we're going to want to say something about the big picture of why. So this is the little picture of why. Somebody didn't like him. But this is the big picture of why. Forgiveness and some complicated Bible term called atonement. Okay, so let me kind of work through a couple of these. Trials, how would we translate that? Pilate actually does a really good job. Pontius Pilate says, you guys don't like him very much. He accuses the Pharisees and the chief priest of jealousy. And that's probably about it. Why would we need to say that? Because I don't want people to think, especially children, that Jesus was a bad guy who was killed as a criminal, right? But he died because some people were jealous of him. There were people who were powerful who didn't like what he was doing. That's the small-scale reason of why. Anybody have any better way of saying that? I kind of struggled with what to say about that. Because somehow, I mean, this is the struggle. You're in little kids' class all through these classes. Jesus is great. Everybody loves Jesus. And then at one point, your parents tell them, and then we killed them. We killed him. Capital punishment. And you have to explain, why? Somewhere in the life of Jesus, he did something that made people, a lot of people, want to kill him. And they did. That's something about the life of Christ that can't be overlooked. He did something that made a lot of people really angry. And Christians say it's the same thing as all the good things, right? It was the good things he did that made people really angry. But somehow we have to talk about that. I think jealousy is a word that kids would probably understand. Crucifixion. How do you explain crucifixion to kids? Yeah, good luck. Jesus was killed. Yeah. So at the basic level, I'm going to have a lot, most of today's class is going to be about the crucifixion and how to talk about it. At the most basic level, Jesus was killed. Later in this class, down the road several weeks, we'll have a class just on talking to kids about death. And so probably want to circle around to that. If you haven't been able to have a successful conversation with your child about dying, then there's probably not a lot you can say about the crucifixion yet. That's a good hint to you, right? If you're trying to figure out, when do I talk to him about the death of Jesus? I don't want to be... See, this is where I get insensitive. If they haven't had a family member die, you're having a struggle because you haven't been to the funeral home yet and you haven't had that experience with them. That's not saying you have to wait for someone to die to be able to talk about the gospel, but I'm saying those are related conversations, be able to talk about death and be able to talk about the crucifixion, because it's a story. At its heart, it's a story about someone dying. And if they don't get death, then they're going to struggle with that. Okay. It's more than just death. It's a heinous, terrible, awful death. That's the rated R part. I'll have to get to that in a second. Burial. With little tiny kids, I sometimes use the word cave, right? Because it's cut out of the side of a hill, of a cliff, sort of, right? And so it's not dig 6 feet down and drop them. It's into a cutout of a cave. And so I don't know how you say that, but do you something along the lines of cave, big stone, right? Because that's important to the resurrection story. The angel didn't come with a shovel and dig Jesus out. It was a big stone, and he's in kind of what looks like a cave. And if a kid, if you show like a three-year-old an Easter picture, you know, and it's got the little hump rock, right? This is what all of them have. It's the little humpy rock, and then it's got the... nice, neat circle in it, and they go, oh, cave, right? They know what that is. It's a cave. We're looking for bats. And so if that's a word that helps, yeah, it's kind of like a cave, and that's where they buried him and covered him. Resurrection, God made Jesus alive again, right? Not terribly complicated. I think kids get that one better than we do, honest to goodness. I think we have reservations. We have become so enamored with the consequences of death that... For us, resurrection is hard to imagine. For kids, it's a lot easier. They have to kind of unlearn it, sadly. That for them, why wouldn't death be temporary? Why not? If God wanted it to be temporary, of course it would. And then forgiveness and atonement. Something like Jesus suffered so we don't have to. That is a really dicey one, because you're talking atonement. There's a couple different takes on it. There's a legal approach to it. You could say, you know, it's a legal issue. There's a crime and a punishment, and someone has to pay the punishment. You can think about it like a transaction, right? There's a debt. Someone has to pay a debt. He paid a debt. We have a song about that, right? You can talk about it in terms of suffering. There was suffering, but he took it in our place, right? There's a couple different words that you can use, different pictures, and the Bible uses all of those to the point that preachers kind of tend to have their favorite one, and then they argue with each other about which one is the best way to describe it. But in some way, Jesus, in the place of, there is some kind of substitution. It may not be the one you have in mind, but there's some kind of substitution for you that takes place at the cross. So now you see maybe where, in a sense, there's no hard words to learn. It's not like when we're talking about God and we say, what does omnipotent mean? There's no hard words to learn. But conceptually, actually the story of the cross and the resurrection are actually kind of complicated ideas to convey to children well. Okay. Questions on that slide before we dive in trying to do it? Okay. So step one. How do you convey the crucifixion to kids? You're going to have to take a look at your kid. This is absolutely an age-appropriate question. What would you think about your kid seeing a rated R movie? Would be a question I would ask, right? The Passion of the Christ, it's rated R, right? For a reason. There's no foul language, no gratuitous sex, right? But it's enormously violent. So if you have a moral qualm showing your kids that, then you're going to find some other way to talk to them about crucifixion, because there's no tidy way to talk about capital punishment, and that's what it was. It was a gruesome form of capital punishment made to utterly humiliate a human being who had stood against the Roman Empire. That's what crucifixion was. So if they're up to it, you can't do better than the Passion in terms of showing the kind of visceral imagery of the cross. But obviously, little kids aren't going to do well with this. And I wouldn't recommend it. Who saw it in theater when it came out? Show of hands. Okay. Some of you remember that? Okay. Yeah. It was uncomfortable. I mean, Anyway. Because of Mel Gibson's particular cinematic flair for, like, the violent, it becomes like this incredible pictorial set of images that maybe only he could capture in his strangeness or be able to show that. That no one else has ever dared. Typically, it's Christian, more conservative thinking Christian movie makers who do movies about Jesus, and they don't want to show that stuff. It's gross to them. Gibson's like, yeah, we'll do rated R. Yeah, why not? So it's pretty gruesome. So at what age would you show that type of imagery to your kid? Huh?
Depends on the kid.
It depends a lot on the kid. Listen, and spoilers here. Lucas cries when Han Solo dies, okay? I mean, he didn't make it. What? Han Solo dies? Yeah, I know. That when this happens, we took him to see the Star Wars movie in theater, and he's in a ball of tears, and people are like, is he okay? Yeah, I'll be fine. this would not be something he could handle. When characters die in movies, he does not do well. So the visceral imagery of this would be more you can handle. That's nine.
That's fiction.
And that's fiction. And you're watching this and you're trying to say, actually, this really happened. Okay. So that imagery, you're going to have a struggle conveying that in a meaningful way to younger children. There's not a shortcut to that. But if your kids are old enough, I do recommend, it's one of those movies, I've actually only ever seen it once. And I told myself I never wanted to see it again. Like, it had that big of an impact on me that I didn't want to ever watch it twice. It wasn't one you're like, hey, want to watch Passion tonight? Yeah, it's a fun one. It's not that kind of movie. You can't do it. But it's one you kind of want to have on hand. I think we have a copy around here somewhere that used to be running around. That, you know, you want to be able to show it. But it's a very niche moment where you say, right there, I think they would be benefited from seeing this. Okay.
Yeah.
14 and 10,
yeah.
And you recommend that?
Well,
for,
for them.
For them, yeah. How did they do with it?
Fine.
Tears?
Yes.
Yeah. And appropriate. Yeah, I'm not saying kids should have a good reaction. You know, you don't walk out of that like a Marvel movie. You're supposed to walk out and be like, that was the worst thing I've ever seen. Okay, and at home, I like the idea of in an environment where you can answer questions and talk about it. Not, all right, kids, dump your popcorn, let's go. You know, having a nice environment for it, I think, is good. Well, we might not want to wait until that age to talk about the crucifixion. I don't. And so what other options are there? We can talk about it in less brutal terminology, okay? But just understand, you, until he's dead and brutally murdered, you haven't got to the crucifixion yet, right? You're only getting parts of it because he's dead and he's brutally murdered in that story. So, deal with it, Zach. C.S. Lewis was trying to answer this question for us. He imagined, what if we could tell a kid a fantasy story that they could appreciate at a younger age that had the sense of the gospel story in it, so that when they got to it later, they would recognize it. And so the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, has the story of Aslan, this tremendous lion who's king of his little world, okay? And in the story, someone makes a deal with a bad person, abbreviating here, and it's sad because I can't just read to you C.S. Lewis for 45 minutes. And as a consequence, his life is going to be forfeit, but the lion agrees to take his place. Okay, so when they made that movie, let's see if it, there we go. Apparently it feels like Zach about C.S. Lewis. It really did just crush it. That's how powerful the imagery is.
Has anyone not seen it?
Anyone not seen? How are you a deacon? That's what I mean.
All
right, we're going to have tonight here. Yeah, we'll have to do a Sigarnia night. Okay, so they kill the lion, is the point. The reason I was going to show you the clip is because the clip itself is actually pretty sinister and dark. I mean, it's not Mel Gibson dark, but, you know, giant knife plunged into a lion, and you like the lion. He's not a bad guy, the lion.
Well, and they're doing stuff to humiliate him, like cut his mane.
They cut his mane.
Yeah, they're doing.
Yeah, it's humiliating imagery, and there's lots of, you know, scary creatures around. The witch lady is scary. Even that, I'll just tell you, if we show that movie to Lucas right now, he's going to cry through that entire scene. Right, so even that is an image that is difficult because you have a main character dying, right? Okay, so let's say, let's get my C.S. Lewis.
Even the imagery too, that he's literally on like a sacrificial altar.
Yeah.
In the movie,
right, yeah.
So that's a part of the imagery too, is that it's an actual sacrifice.
Yep.
I recommend the cartoon for even newer ones, because that one was almost too much for me.
Yeah, yeah. There is a cartoon rendition of Narnia. Yeah. Which brings me to my next question then. At what point, make it better, make it go. At what point have we reduced the crucifixion to no longer be helpful? So I like Narnia. I like the cinematic version of Narnia. I like the cartoon version of Narnia. I don't like cartoon versions of the crucifixion. Okay. For me, there should not exist a cartoon version of capital punishment execution. Right? You wouldn't make a cartoon of somebody on electric chair. Right? That would be a strange Saturday morning cartoon. Right? Unless it's Daffy Duck. You can electrocute him all you want. But that's the point. If you come away from it with a Daffy Duck-like experience, right, that Jesus would become Elmer Fudd on a cross, then we did not do this kid any good, right? That was not a good way to communicate the information.
You know,
you're doing like wizardry up there.
A really good, like, you may disagree. There is a cartoon out there. It's called the Easter Story. We may have it here. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And I thought they did a decent job. It is a cartoon, but I mean, it opens the door to be able to talk about things.
It's easier, especially if your emphasis is on the resurrection at the end. It's definitely easier to show living Jesus at the end in cartoon fashion. It's the act of the crucifixion itself that I struggle with in anime. That's a difficult image. Ma'am.
Well, I was just going to say, I know like for my kids, they would almost be scared, you know, to see that kind of a scene.
Yeah.
And it not, maybe, it would upset them, but maybe not like, oh, I'm sad upset, but like scared about it.
Yeah.
So I know I would have to kind of like really mellow it down until they got, you know, older and more age appropriate.
That's a good thought, because we do want them to be upset by it. If they see it and they're not upset by the crucifixion, you've done a really bad job. But we don't want them scared of Jesus, right? So how do you get to upset without fear?
Right.
You know, and that is a difficult, mature level to be able to walk, that a child, some children get it at different ages, some don't.
I may be off, but I'm just
you
curious,
are.
Like, why not just read the gospel story, right? And just read the scriptures to them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I've done with my kids, in that hearing it, I mean, you're still hearing he's being whipped, he's being nails driven through this. I mean, hearing it, you're getting the sense of it, and you're getting straight scripture. But seeing, like, a visual thing is a lot more scary to me than just hearing.
And let me comment on that I'm not trying to suggest that any of this that I'm suggesting replaces just reading the text.
Mm-hmm.
But my concern, because kids don't know much about, in the text, for example,
mm-hmm.
it never tells you about what it means to be crucified. All four gospel accounts just say, "and they crucified him," like four words. And they assume that you know what that means, because any person in the first century knew what it meant. So they didn't have to say, "and here's what that looks like." They just say, "and they crucified him." So it's for us, like the modern audience, that we have to talk about what's that. And so to read it, if you can find a way to kind of just read through that with them and say, "yeah, it kind of means this," great.
And afterwards you have like the disciple that sees him and he says, "look at my hands, look at my feet." Like you can talk about, I mean, that's where I got in trouble with Brody. Well, if no bones had ever been broken, how did the and I was like,
I mean, that's, but for us, you know, what is it, even what it means by putting nail through hands, the first century person knew where the nail went and they understood that. We have to kind of think, all right, what, how did that, So I guess my grand summary, since someone killed my PowerPoint. It was me. C.S. Lewis killed my PowerPoint, that's the truth. Is with talking about the crucifixion, you do want to think about it in an age-appropriate sense. You're going to use this as a way to gauge, in my mind, the readiness for the baptism discussion next week. That if you can't have a meaningful conversation about crucifixion, then you really probably shouldn't be having a meaningful conversation about baptism. That they are two connected stories. I don't want to baptize children to reenact the crucifixion, death, burial, and resurrection, and their parents wouldn't even tell them about the crucifixion. Does that make sense? And so we always get in that huge debate. We'll save this for next week. Huge debate about, like, when are kids ready to be baptized? And we have different points of view. But a set of guidelines that will help you is, at what level can you talk to them about the crucifixion? Use that as a guideline. And when I say crucifixion, I mean actual crucifixion. At some point, Jesus has to be very painfully dead in your description of it. Does that make some sense? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
What I like about having Tucker and Riley grow up here is because I feel like back in our classes, we do such a good job, even from our two-year-old classes up, just teaching the basic steps of the whole gospel story. And as they get older, it's filling in those blanks a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper. But even, like, you know, even Calvin back there, when we're doing the stories, he knows the steps of it.
Yeah.
Those little ones knows the, you know, they all know those steps. But as we go, we're filling in the blanks deeper and deeper.
And that's the challenge. I mean, there's the sequence that the youngest child can get words in sequence. Thank you. But then it's the significance of it.
Right.
And you don't want to wait till they're 20 and then say, "oh, it's about time for me to talk about your Lord and Savior," right? But there are some things that they're only going to get as they grow. Not everything in the Bible is PG or even G, right? The book of Judges, there is no good way to teach the second half of the book of Judges to children, because it's about gang rape and dismemberment. I mean, it's just, there's not a cartoon, there should never be a cartoon version of that, right? It's not age appropriate. It was written for adults, okay? But that said, there's still information in there that's valuable. And so you have to be a discerning parent, even with God's book, because God wrote it to adults, and say, how then do I convey this and at what time to my children? Okay? With younger kids, what you can emphasize without reservation are the good works and good deeds of Jesus and his life, which sadly we stop talking about when we get to be adults, and I don't know why. But you can absolutely double down on that. Those make for great cartoons, right? Feeding thousands of people and all those things and healing people. That's fantastic stuff. There's a reason when we do VBS, we do the miracles of Jesus. We don't have a VBS on the crucifixion of Jesus. Now, why not? Because the idea, I mean, Selena and I have discussed it. Wouldn't it be great to do like a gospel VBS? And we can talk about it. No, we can't figure out how to appropriately, from 2 to 10, portray the crucifixion of Jesus in pantomime or in arts and crafts, right? I mean, it's an unimaginable challenge. So we don't do that. But we can do the miracles and parables. That preaches well to all ages.
Well, we did the life of Jesus, but we did it as a storytelling. We did it from the apostles' standpoint.
We did. We talked about some of it, what the apostles might have seen. We talked about it kind of at a distance once. Yeah. It was very nerve-wracking. And should be. You know the Mo Gibson story that nobody on set wanted to be the guy, the Roman soldier who drove the nails into Jesus' hands? That they couldn't get anybody who wanted to do that part on film. And so the actual, you know, see the person, it's just the hands with the hammer, is actually Mo Gibson, who is the one driving the nails, because no one else would agree to do it. I mean, there's something about it that is gruesome and disturbing, and it should be. Except for Mel Gibson. Mad Max could do anything. Okay. 10 minutes left or thereabouts. 6 minutes left, something like that. Another resource that I find helpful, this is close as I'm going to get to Cartoon Jesus. If you haven't visited thebibleproject.com, fantastic resource. They have a video for every book of the Bible that takes you through a chapter overview of what that book's about and conceptually what the book's about. And it's very approachable. It's made for adults, but for teens and preteens, I think it'd be very helpful. They have one that's topical on the subject of atonement. I'm going to show you the first half of it this week, and then next week I'll show you the second half of the atonement video, and I'll have this link available if you want it later, but it's thebibleproject.com, and if we don't crash...
We all long for the world to be good, for people to live in peace, act with love and justice, but... there's a problem. Something compels us humans to constantly wreak havoc and destruction instead, and we call this evil.
And from the Bible's point of view, evil ruins things in at least two ways. There's a direct effect of our evil, like when someone steals from another person, they've created injustice.
Yeah, therefore, you know, they owe something to make it right.
But there's another indirect effect of evil. Because they've also ruined the environment of the relationship, creating a lack of trust, there's emotional damage. It's like vandalism, and they need to make that right, too.
Now, many people believe, hey, God is good, he should be the one to just get rid of all the evil in the world.
But let's be honest, I mean, the evil that I see everywhere out there, it's the same evil that's inside of me. We have all contributed, and we keep doing it.
And so this kind of puts us in a bind. If God's going to rid the world of evil, he'll have to get rid of us.
And this is what's so remarkable about the story of the Bible. This God is so good that not only is he going to rid the world of evil, he's going to do it without destroying humanity.
So how is he going to do that?
Well, early in the story of the Bible, we're introduced to this practice of animal sacrifice, which, I know, it seems weird to us, but for the Israelites, it was a very powerful symbol of God's justice and of his grace. So remember, I'm a contributor to the evil that's in the world. I should be removed. But God is allowing this animal's life to be a substitute. It's symbolically dying in my place. And the biblical word for this is atonement, which means to cover over someone's death. But there's a second part to this ritual. Remember, evil also causes this relational vandalism. And in the Bible, this idea is described as polluting or defiling the land and making it unclean. So the priest would symbolically wash away the vandalism by sprinkling the animal's blood in different parts of the temple.
So the animal's blood is cleaning things?
Well, remember, this is a symbol, and it's a symbol that we're not used to. The blood represents life. And the sprinkling of the blood is this representation of how God is cleaning away these indirect consequences of evil in their community. In the Bible, this process is called purification. And so the temple and the land now become a clean space where God and his people can live together in peace.
So this ritual makes things right between Israel and God.
And more than that, the Israelites experience God's love and his grace through these symbols. And by being forgiven, ideally, this would compel them to become people of love and grace too.
Right, that's the ideal, but it wasn't always happening.
Right. So the prophet Isaiah, for example, he talks a lot about this. He opens his book by saying that the continual sacrifices of the Israelites had become meaningless because they were also allowing great evil in their midst, ignoring the poor and the oppressed. Even the Israelite kings were distorting justice. But Isaiah looked forward to a day when a new king from the line of David would come and deal with evil, but in a surprising way. The king would become a servant, and not just serve, but also suffer and die for the evil committed by his own people. And his life would be offered as a sacrifice.
This is the promise Jesus believed he was fulfilling. He's the king of Israel suffering and dying on the cross.
In fact, Jesus himself used Isaiah's words when he said that he came to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And that word ransom refers to a sacrifice of atonement. And so all over the New Testament, we hear about how Jesus' death was an atoning sacrifice for us. It covered the debt that humans owe God for contributing to all of the evil and death in his world. But the New Testament authors also talk about Jesus' death as providing purification. And so we hear about Jesus' blood as a symbol of his life, having this ability to wash away the vandalism that evil has caused in us and around us, so we can now live at peace with God.
So that's the meaning behind Jesus' death. But there's more to the story.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that next week. There's more to the story. So what I like about these videos, if you don't show them to your kids, I haven't, but I like to look at them myself to give myself a picture in my own head and some vocabulary to talk about it. Sin as a kind of vandalism that has to be cleaned, and debt as a sacrifice. That language is actually really helpful to me, and I use these videos all the time. I'm not kidding. Edwin calls me up and says, "Hey, I want you to teach a class on Judges." I go watch the video on Judges to get like a 5-minute bird's eye view of what conceptually do I want to say about Judges. And then I go write my notes on 13 weeks for the class. And they're very helpful of giving you a bird's eye view of the picture of the imagery of the book. So I recommend that program. Thoughts or comments on the crucifixion? Or we're completely done. Ma'am.
Because I know I've brought people who haven't been to church, in a church, and we're singing about blood,
yeah,
and Jesus and stuff, and it weirds them out. But as someone who grows up in the church,
yeah,
it's never been a weird thing to me to talk about that. And I think that's because if you start at an early age and you,
yeah,
teach those things, not that you're desensitized, but
yeah,
it is normalized.
That's absolutely true. That you are already ahead of the game by having your kids in this environment on a regular basis. That they are familiarized with language. You're going to talk about the crucifixion and it's not going to be a shock to them. Or blood being important, because their favorite song is There's Power in the Blood. They may have no idea why, but they like to sing power, right? So, I mean, they get a head start with the language here for sure. Okay, next week, start on responses to that. Thank you.